From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield.
And responding to a disaster of this magnitude will require every element of our national capacity.
That was President Barack Obama pledging America's support to Haiti in the wake of the catastrophic earthquake there late Tuesday afternoon. But before most relief agencies could get assistance to the island and before the U.S. military could fully mobilize, one element of our national capacity was on the ground in Port-au-Prince.
The news of the hour from Port-au-Prince, Haiti is this.
Brian Williams of NBC Nightly News and Katie Couric of the CBS Evening News arrived within 24 hours of the quake. ABC's Diane Sawyer was on her way. For all the cutbacks and bureau closings, there are some stories that are so large and so terrible that the anchor has to be photographed in front of them. This is, of course, a story that does require the media to go all in, despite having ignored the ongoing catastrophe that is Haiti for the past decade. But catastrophe journalism is always a grim reminder of basic journalism in ruins. In the case of Haiti, its local media was in literal ruins, impeding Haitians from getting the information that could be the difference between life and death. To address that problem, another organization is on the ground in Haiti. Internews, the nonprofit that cultivates journalism in the developing world, is bringing in the physical means for Haitian journalists to get the story to the island itself. Mark Frohart is the group's vice president for health and humanitarian media. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Bob.
I'm assuming that most of the broadcast infrastructure in Haiti was lost along with most everything else. Do you have any specific details on that?
We have a person on the ground. He's been living there for about 4 years. We've found out from him that there's at least one radio station which is up on the air. Beyond that, we think there might be one or two television stations getting information out, but we don't know how much of that is really information about the response or the crisis.
What do you bring in with you? How do you set up a radio station in a country that has been flattened?
After the tsunami in 2004, we actually brought in a couple of suitcase radios. These are small, low-powered stations that can reach 20, 30 kilometers in some cases, and get those up and running in place of damaged infrastructure. Because while these small suitcase stations are a stopgap measure, what's most important is to get the existing stations back on the air. And so as quickly as possible, we bring in replacement equipment to rebuild the damaged infrastructure. Another problem that we've often encountered, and we've also heard that this was one of the things that affected journalists during the Hurricane Katrina aftermath, is that journalists that are working, because their families have been affected by the crisis, they have to stand in food lines, repair their house, take care of their family. And so one of the things that we can do also, for example, we did in Aceh, was actually had the capacity not only to provide cell phones and recorders to the journalists, but also some payment so that they could have other people stand in those food lines for them so that they could spend more time actually developing and producing news for the broader population.
I was surprised to learn that Haiti had a fairly far-flung media infrastructure, at least broadcast media. A lot of radio stations had been built there in recent years. Had Internews had any connection with those stations till now?
Absolutely. And you're absolutely right with regard to the extent to which stations have grown up around the country. The government opened up the licensing procedures, and there was a plethora of radio stations, community stations that were started up at all levels. We were working with a network of 41 community radio stations throughout the country. The network is called RAMAC, and they're the group that we had been working with for about 3 years before this devastation occurred. We're trying to reestablish contact with them right now. We found out that a few of the stations are down. We don't know much about those which are outside of Port-au-Prince, and we're in the process right now of really trying to figure out what is the status both of the personnel as well as the infrastructure.
At a time like this, the world coalesces and the amount of money that flows into disaster relief is really enormous. I wonder, as you stand in line for your organization for disaster relief, whether because you're just media, you get short shrift.
That used to be the case. Media was always seen as an add-on, as kind of a luxury. And then the 2005 World Disaster Report by the International Federation of Red Cross pointed out that information can actually save lives in these situations. We have found it a little bit easier more recently because donors are seeing how the media and information can really improve the response. It has a dramatic effect on the efficiency of a humanitarian response because people know where the assistance is. They have a better understanding of who the humanitarian organizations are and what they're about. And it just really improves the ability for the affected population to be able to respond. And now more and more donors are actually starting to see that. So although we're not over the hump yet, things are getting a bit better.
All right, Mark. I know you're trying to get out of Washington and get to Port-au-Prince. I very much appreciate you spending the time with us.
All right. Thank you very much.
Mark Frohart is Vice President for Health and Humanitarian Media at Internews. Next week, the president's deadline to close the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center will pass unmet. Legal and security obstacles have stymied the administration, and the Gitmo prison will remain open. Strangely, though the debate about Guantanamo has raged on for 8 years, in all that time, we've almost never seen the faces of the detainees at the center of it. That's because the military prohibits photos that show detainees' faces under a Geneva Conventions policy against parading prisoners. But some of these men are faceless no more. Last year, the Miami Herald learned that the military had allowed the International Committee of the Red Cross to photograph the prisoners. In the pictures, the detainees are casual. They're smiling and posing for relatives back home whom, in many cases, hadn't seen their family member for years. When the Herald learned of those photos, it contacted the families and turned up 15 photographs in all, which we will link to on our site. For the Herald's Carol Rosenberg, after years of covering Guantanamo, it was a shock to see the face of one of those men for the first time, someone she'd only read about in court briefings.
I was handed one of these pictures back in May, and I looked at this man, and he looked like no one I'd ever seen at Guantanamo. He had a picture of his kids. He was sitting dressed in traditional, I guess you could say, Saudi attire. He looked well. He looked like he was posing in a photo studio anywhere, frankly, in the Muslim world. And it struck me because I've spent dozens and dozens of days in the prison camps, and I've never seen anything as intimate as that picture.
I got to tell you, the one that really got me was the image of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged mastermind behind the attacks of 9/11. The image that we have been seeing of him for the last, I guess, 7 years is when he was being taken into custody. He looked like he had just been skimmed off of Skid Row. He was wearing a T-shirt exposing chest hair. He needed a shave. He looked like he hadn't slept in 4 days. The image on the Miami Herald website looks like it could be his, I don't know, his graduation photo. He just looks so doe-eyed and innocent. And, you know, I don't know whether that reveals anything about him or reveals why the military didn't want these pictures out there to begin with.
Now, we can only guess, but we've seen him in court and we are aware of some aspects of his personality. He's vain. And he may very well be aware of that original photo, but he chose the picture that we call doe-eyed because he looks pious. He looks serious. If you pull back from the close-up on that, he's on his knees in prayer. And he got to pick, just like all of these guys. The way it worked is the Red Cross took pictures, digital photos, and let them pick the pictures of themselves they liked best. So he chose to look like that for the outside world. And it did cause a sensation. People were angry, frustrated that the man accused of carrying out the September 11th attacks looked so comfortable, looked so at peace in Guantanamo.
You mentioned that several of the detainees look ordinary and pious. You know, there's another word I might throw in there, and that is serene. Some of them look just plain happy, you know, big toothy grins and so forth. It's such cognitive dissonance, especially if claims of torture are true. Certainly they have not been in country club conditions at Guantanamo. Is this, do you suppose, for the benefit of their families? Are they making a political statement? What's behind all the grins?
The Red Cross delegate who took many of the pictures told me they only had their families in mind, and they wanted their family to take a look at the picture and say, they're okay. And in a couple of instances, I was told that they genuinely were happy. They took an hour out of their prison camp routine. The Red Cross brought a kit bag filled with traditional head coverings for these portraits that were going home. And so they spent an hour in front of a mirror, arranging themselves. And they looked into the cameras of the Red Cross, and they said to the family, here I am. It is no Guantanamo that the world has ever seen.
Have you heard from the military about this? I mean, are they disgusted with you for gathering these images and sharing them with the public?
What I heard from some people in the military was they didn't necessarily like the fact that maybe these folks looked innocent, but they did like the fact that they were smiling, that they were healthy. They were almost like you could say a poster of the talking point that the Pentagon has been trying to promote for all these years: safe, humane, transparent. The irony, of course, is it wasn't their transparency that got these pictures. They've never allowed us to take pictures like this.
How about you as a reporter? You have spent more time at Gitmo probably than any other American reporter. How has it changed your perspective on Guantanamo?
I write about Guantanamo full time. And you can write about the debate, you can write about the discussion, you can write about the trials and the policy. But I wanted to tell a different story. And it goes back to that first photo on January 11th, 2002, that in many people's mind is Guantanamo, 20 guys on their knees in a cage. And if I've done anything or tried to do anything in the 8 years is make those men individuals. And for better or worse, that's what this mosaic does. It takes the men out of the cage and out of the orange jumpsuits and lets you look in their eyes. I don't know that anyone can make any decisions about what you see in their eyes, and I don't know that you should. That's what the courts are for. That's why we have the rule of law. But it does change the dynamic of what you see at Guantanamo when you're not looking inside a cage with men on their knees in orange jumpsuits being put into Guantanamo on that very first day by the military.
Carol, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Carol Rosenberg covers Guantanamo Bay Detention Facility for the Miami Herald. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Last summer, the Washington Post, in an attempt to increase revenue, planned a series of underwritten off-the-record salons whereby a sponsor could pay for the opportunity to meet with government officials and others to discuss, say, health care or financial regulation. Oh, and the meetings were to be hosted by Washington Post reporters. By charging private access to its editorial staff and its sources, the Post set itself up for charges of influence peddling and eventually abandoned the plan. Once news of the salons went public, the response from the top brass at the Post was swift. They said the whole thing was advertised all wrong and that the paper's publisher and managing editor were unaware of some of the details. The man responsible for implementing and marketing the salons was Charles Pelton, a journalist turned media consultant, and though that attempt proved ill-fated, he remains convinced that media outlets should find some way to turn their reporters into profit centers. Some organizations, he points out, are already doing just that. Pelton joins me now. Charles, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much, Bob. It's nice to be here.
So the old way of generating revenue was through advertising, which was an indirect way to exploit the value of your editorial staff. You're talking about something far more direct. Give me some examples.
Well, many of your listeners are familiar with The Economist magazine. Fewer are familiar with The Economist's research division, which is The Economist Intelligence Unit. What The Economist Intelligence Unit does is produce regular reports or custom, which means specially ordered reports about the future of countries, the future of specific industries, media, steel, whatever. And this isn't just about producing reports. It's about participating in conferences and events. It's about leading public forums. It's about doing studies. It's about doing all of that following journalistic principles.
Okay, let me ask you about a hypothetical news organization, a national newspaper that covers the Defense Department, the Pentagon, and also covers defense contractors. And let's just say a reporter from the paper is deployed to go speak to one of the defense contractors, let's say Northrop Grumman or General Dynamics, to give the lay of the land in the defense procurement landscape. Now the reporter the next day shows up at the Pentagon to talk to the Secretary of Defense, obviously his most important news source. Can the defense secretary look at this reporter anymore as a journalist, as an honest broker, or is he going to look at that person as someone who is on the payroll of General Dynamics?
The journalist is not on the payroll of General Dynamics. The journalist is on the payroll of the media organization for which he or she works. I like your government example quite a bit, because journalists who cover Washington or who cover their local city hall or their police departments have so much information and knowledge about the bureaucracies and the politicians that they cover that never make it into print, never make it on a blog post. That is information that is lost, and it's lost to the public. I think the Washington example is so good because it actually points to a chance for media that covers government to participate in open governance.
So as fraught as this ecosystem would be with potential conflict, would you advise a news organization to offer to a paying audience off the record the kind of journalism that they insist be on the record for their ordinary readers?
I think that's absolutely one of the toughest questions. Media organizations' prime responsibility is to their audiences, the public and the citizenry. Off the record and on the record, and whether or not something is for attribution, I think is kind of a red herring question, and I'll tell you why. Every day, every waking business minute that a journalist works his or her beat, they're engaged in off the record or not for attribution conversations with their sources. When they hear something that can be used for a public story, it is their responsibility always to either get it checked with a second source so it can be used, or a third source, or to drag that particular source on the record. That doesn't change, nor should it change if you are also creating reports for business or for government.
All right, Charles. Thank you so much.
I have one concluding thought.
Okay.
This is not a question of the journalist's responsibility to find another form of work or to become a famous blogger or a pundit. It's a question of the responsibility of the media organization to reinvent itself so that it has a more entrepreneurial culture within the ranks of the people producing the news, the analysis, and the content. You should not let all this talent go. You should instead reinvent yourself as a media organization.
Charles Pelton is a former reporter and a media consultant.
Thank you, Bob.
So, as we've just heard, Pelton believes that news organizations need to reorganize and rebrand if they're ever to see profits again. But some journalists are taking the initiative themselves. During the 2008 election season, journalist Anna Marie Cox solicited donations from readers to help pay her expenses after the magazine she was reporting for folded. She collected more than $7,000, enough to keep reporting for some while after her redundancy. And then there's Paige Williams. She's a journalist who last year found herself laid off and in possession of what she thought was a great magazine feature. The story she wanted to write was about Dolly Freed, a woman who'd been famous in the 70s after writing a book, Possum Living, about her teenage years spent living off the grid. Williams decided that Freed's story of jobless self-sufficiency in hard times was relevant to today's dismal economic climate. But while she was able to find the reclusive Freed, she couldn't find a magazine willing to publish her story.
I had infinite faith that Dolly was worth something, but no one agreed with me. So,
you didn't wait around to find a magazine that was willing to publish your piece. You just went out and wrote it essentially on spec, and that is not cheap. It cost you $2,000?
Well over $2,000. That's the $2,000 is just what I've documented so far.
But some people thought it was worth cash money because you went out and asked for donations to help you cover your reporting expenses, and you know, some people have ponied up. How much money have you raised to date?
Well, I checked yesterday, and I think we were up to $823, and that was 71 donors. It's interesting. They're coming in everywhere from Chattanooga, Tennessee, to Australia and Brazil.
Tell me about the range of donations.
Well, it's been so far from 75 cents to $100. The 75 cents is my absolute favorite because I just wonder what sort of mental calculations went into that decision. It's my absolute favorite.
Now, do you think that's like leaving a 9-cent tip at a restaurant?
I don't know. Maybe this guy was thinking about the story in terms of the architecture of a magazine and how much he would be willing to pay for each piece.
Now, everybody's interest in Dolly from the get-go is that she has lived off the fat of the land. And I'm curious whether she sent you any cash or, you know, I don't know, sewing, tree bark.
No, I mean, she clicked on PayPal and she sent $50. She was dismayed to find out that I would have to give the money back because I explained to her that I can't take money from the people that I write about. She did give the photographer some dewberry jelly, which I'm really jealous of.
Okay, now, the reason we're talking to you is not just because of the novelty of it. In fact, it's not entirely novel. Radiohead has done this with Tracks, and other journalists have done similar things. But I wonder if you think that this is in any way a scalable model, that henceforth writers who do write on spec needn't really worry about selling the magazine pitch, but just doing it their own selves.
I'm a little reluctant to say that it can work just across the board. I mean, I did this not as an attempt to set up a model. I did it just to try to get a story out there about an interesting person and a book that I found fascinating.
Furthermore, and I hope you won't think I'm being cruel here, strictly speaking, it hasn't even worked for you. You're still, you know, at least $1,200 in the hole.
No, that's not cruel. That's accurate. It's not worked so far. If it does work, it'll take some time. The $2,000 that I laid out in expenses, you know, I'm a long way off from that. And that's okay. I just wanted to see what would happen.
I suspect that the publicity you're getting for this will help your PayPal account. But I'd kind of like to put this into perspective. For a writer of your stature, a story like this, had it been picked up by a magazine, at least in the good old days, would have been worth 6,000 words. It would have been worth a minimum of $6,000 and probably up to 20-some thousand dollars, depending on the venue.
Mm-hmm.
Can you still make that money out there as a freelance journalist, or has just everything dried up?
Maybe if you're a certain kind of freelance journalist, if your name is so out there that people can't sleep without getting you into their pages.
Yeah, so let me, instead of talking optimistically about this new opportunity to raise money directly from readers for substantial pieces of journalism, if it doesn't work out with magazines in extremis and the freelance business itself under a great deal of pressure, what does this say for the future of long-form journalism?
I don't know. I think what we're seeing is just a fracturing of the whole machine, and it's going to blow around for a while and then come back in some different form. And for long-form storytellers, I just don't know that the real estate is going to be there anymore. The better part of me hopes that it will, of course, but I'm not sure that more than a few people will have the opportunity to do that kind of work.
Paige, thank you very much. I wish you all the best in recouping your investment, even if it's at 75 cents a pop.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Paige Williams is a journalist and now executive editor of Boston Magazine. You can read her story about Dolly Freed at her website, www.paige-williams.com. Time was you graduated from journalism school and got a job, albeit a low-level one, paying your dues, covering school board meetings, or scrambling for a fleeting moment of airtime. After a few years, you graduated to more authorship, bigger stories, more investigation, and so forth and so on. Journalism school touted itself as a leg up on that ladder. Well, that was then. These days, with less demand and the very idea of a viable journalism industry in serious, serious doubt, journalism training is beginning to reflect the new world order. But should journalism schools be training their students to better sell themselves? Jeff Jarvis is an associate professor and director of the Interactive Journalism Program at the City University of New York's new Graduate School of Journalism, where he's been building what he calls entrepreneurial journalists. And he says there's nothing impure about it.
We were told when we came up through the business to keep our hands away from that filthy lucre. And the result is, I think we gave journalism very bad stewardship. And a lot of the reason that we're in trouble today is because journalists didn't understand their own business.
So what specifically are you teaching to get modern journalism students more attuned to the realities of the marketplace?
In my class in entrepreneurial journalism, all the students create a business plan for a new product, a sustainable, that is to say profitable, journalistic enterprise. And we were lucky we had $100,000 in seed money from the McCormick Foundation to give the best of these businesses money to actually start. We have a jury of entrepreneurs, investors, publishers, editors who decide who gets the money. And we have seven businesses now starting. They're very different. Along the process, though, they learn the same things. They learn an elevator pitch. They learn to look at market analysis and report from the market about what the market really needs. They learn revenue and advertising and how to make that work. They learn the cost side of the business, which we discuss too little these days. And they learn how you can start products and businesses now for so very little because there are great platforms on which you can do it.
You mentioned a variety of approaches. Tell me about the variety. Are we talking about hyperlocal blogs? Are we talking about aggregation sites? Just what?
There's one student who's starting an iPhone app around sports. Two more students are going to create an infrastructure for the assignment of news coverage to bloggers and journalists and journalism students. Another student is working on an algorithmic means to help you prioritize the flow of stuff that you get in. One student is looking at distributing radio shows in her home state in Africa over the phone as phone calls. Another is serving the Ugandan diaspora in the US and the UK. And another has created a platform for educators to share their curriculum and news about science.
When you add up all of these new entrepreneurial approaches, how will that stack up compared to the vast structures of mass media that are now, you know, sort of collapsing beneath our feet?
I presented a study in new business models for news to our faculty at CUNY, and it argued that the big, old, dumb company, newspaper company, is not going to be replaced by some big, smart, new newspaper company. It's going to be replaced by an ecosystem of a couple hundred different players who operate under different motives and means and business models. That's the world our students are going into. We'll still make calls to NPR and the New York Times to help our students get jobs. But the reason I'm teaching entrepreneurial journalism is so we can also prepare students to go start their own jobs, create their own jobs and their own work. Now, at the end of the day, what does journalism look like as a whole? Well, as Clay Shirky says, we don't know. Nothing works and everything works. But I have faith that there is a market demand for journalism and that the market can meet it. The discussion so far about this has mainly been about revenue streams. Advertising's down, we have to charge. You may cue your jingle at will.
Okay, hold it. I'm going to take you up on that.
Present and future business models for monetizing the newspaper industry.
You were saying?
I believe that at the end of the day, journalism is going to be more efficient. We are not going to waste as much effort on duplicative work and commodity work and production, and we're going to put the money where the value is. So what's going to happen is a lot of our students, and indeed, by the way, a lot of the journalists who have left newspapers are now trying to start these enterprises. And part of what we can do in a university is educate them not only in journalism and in new media skills, but also in the business of journalism.
You know, it's certainly my belief that while there will be a lot of journalism going on, the brave new world offers endless opportunity, but the cowardly old world offered pretty big salaries, and that that's going to disappear. And in that sense, I wonder if journalism schools, if they're not just breeding white rats only to have them killed in the laboratory, is there some moral responsibility to warn students that the journalism schools they're applying to are not likely to lead to the kind of careers that previous journalism educations have led to?
Oh, indeed we do. As soon as they come into the school, I give the scared straight talk to the journalists. In fact, when I first did this, when the school opened, I did such a good job that one student put her head in her hands and wailed, "Oh my God, I've made a terrible mistake." I locked the door to keep her in because what followed is a very exciting new world. where, in fact, journalists can make a good living. In our study of new business models at CUNY, we found bloggers now covering suburban towns bringing in $200,000 revenue. We also looked at how to improve their lot so they could bring in $350,000 revenue and hire people to do journalism and hire people to do sales and still take home well over $100,000 a year. When we say that to our students, their response is, okay, teach me to do that.
All right. Well, Jeff, it is always a delight. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
Jeff Jarvis is an associate professor and director of the Interactive Journalism Program at City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism, and he is the author of What Would Google Do? Coming up, Late Night Disarray. It's Deja Vu. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. It was meant to be a novel experiment this week. A court in San Francisco hearing a prominent gay marriage case was going to be videoed with time delay footage appearing later that day on YouTube. The case has garnered a great deal of attention, and anticipation for the footage was high. The move to put cameras in the courtroom was approved by the Ninth Circuit earlier this month and was thought to be a kind of toe in the water on a divisive issue. But on Monday, at the last possible minute, the United States Supreme Court stepped in and shut the experiment down. The case and its resolution will not be televised. The effect of cameras in the courtroom has been a long-standing debate, and the Supreme Court has been resolutely against the idea. So many court watchers saw a strong signal in the 11th hour denial. Adam Liptak has been writing about it for the New York Times, and he joins us once again. Adam, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I said novel, but cameras in the courtroom aren't entirely novel, especially in civil court. Can you give me the landscape?
According to statistics Justice Breyer compiled in his dissent on Wednesday, 42 states allow camera coverage of non-jury civil trials, and there are experiments also in federal trial courts in Manhattan and Brooklyn.
In the majority's unsigned opinion, there was a reference to the possibility for harassment of witnesses who might testify against gay marriage in this case. Now, they may well be right. Is it the court's duty to protect witnesses from harassment for their public testimony?
That's a really interesting question. One thing we know for sure is the people involved are paid experts and advocates who have made it a point to take public positions about these things. So you're not talking about the ordinary kind of trial where witnesses are subpoenaed to arrive in court sometimes against their will. If it were the case that the court should be wary of harassment of people testifying in public trial, maybe you should close the courtroom. Maybe you should ban the print press. Not clear what the additional increment of harassment potential is just because there's also camera coverage.
Reading your story and others, one could not help but have the notion that this had maybe something to do with irregularities in the San Francisco court's procedure, but more to do with the basic ideological split of the court. It was a typical 5-4 decision with the conservative elements of the court prevailing. Does that portend a more precedent-setting decision about cameras in the courtroom at some point in the future?
Well, it certainly was a surprising thing to see the court line up 5-4 with the conservatives plus Kennedy in the majority, the liberals in dissent, because if the question is, should courts follow notice and comment procedure, you would not think that that itself is an ideologically charged question that should divide up people in the usual way. So I think you're right, Bob, to suggest that this does give us some sense that when the court reaches the ultimate issue of are cameras appropriate in this case, it's very likely to say no, and it's very likely to tell us something about its general views about cameras in the courtroom, and those views are likely to follow the views the court has about its own courtroom, which is it doesn't like cameras.
Well, thanks for the "you're right, Bob," but Adam, I divined that based on the headline of your piece, at least online, which said decision breaks down according to ideological lines.
Anytime. So
now we've gotten some hints about what this may augur for rulings on cameras in the courtroom. Have we learned anything about the case which is at the center of all this, the constitutional issue regarding gay marriage in California? Is that even a factor in this conversation?
It seems it's a factor in this sense. The court says, well, if you're going to do this, maybe you shouldn't start with a really high-profile trial. And there's a passage in the majority decision saying that lower courts which have looked at this have started the experiments with low-profile trials, and there's a distinct suggestion that a high-profile trial is a bad idea. And the other thing you might read into it is that it's not a good sign for Ted Olson and David Boies, the lawyers challenging the ban on same-sex marriage, that the Supreme Court has now indicated that it has a distinct sense that it's dealing with a runaway trial court judge.
All right, Adam. As always, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Adam Liptak is the Supreme Court correspondent for The New York Times. This week, while the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission was convening on Capitol Hill to identify the roots of the financial crisis, lawyers from the Federal Reserve were actually asking a U.S. appeals court in New York to strike down a lower court decision that ruled in favor of banking transparency, specifically that the Federal Reserve must disclose details of loans to troubled financial institutions in the worst days of the crisis. The Fed had been sued by Bloomberg News, whose editor-in-chief Matt Winkler spoke to us in late 2008, wondering what collateral had been put up by those struggling banks.
What is the value of these assets? If the Fed is taking them on its balance sheet, that means the Fed is buying and selling assets from these troubled financial institutions to help them so that they can lend money as they used to lend money in a normal way. The marketplace would benefit from knowing what those values are. And as soon as the marketplace does know, well, that's going to help the market begin recovery. It's kind of like once you know what the disease is, then it's a lot easier to begin thinking about, well, what should the cure be?
The debate revolves around the Fed's so-called discount window. This is where, historically, banks with short-term cash flow or liquidity problems would borrow money for a day or two. In the crisis, though, the Fed was lending for up to 3 months at the discount window, a sign of problems far beyond short-term cash flow, which is exactly why the Fed doesn't want to name the borrowers, lest the information trigger a panic and further destabilize an already fragile banking system. Robert Gifra represents the Clearinghouse Association, which has joined with the Fed in the court battle against Bloomberg News, and he argues that the discount window doesn't work if it's too transparent. Gifra joins me now. Bob, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you, Bob?
Well, thank you. So we're talking about trillions of dollars here dispensed at the discount window?
You're talking about many, many billions of dollars, and it could add up to as much as $1 trillion. But discount window lending is, you know, heavily collateralized loans available to any depository institution in the United States, small banks, big banks, and is intended to deal with liquidity issues that banks can have, because it's important to remember banks don't maintain all of the money that they might need to pay back all the depositors on a given day. And we want banks to lend the money out.
The question is, how good is the collateral? These were, by definition, troubled assets that were put up as collateral. And what Bloomberg has been trying to find out is whether the banks put up collateral of value or junk from the basement.
Well, the collateral, in fact, was not junk collateral. The types of collateral the Fed is looking for is already public. I mean, you can get that information by looking on the website. The question is, you know, what was the precise collateral that Bank A or Bank B put up with respect to a particular loan? And that's a different question.
What harm is there to the Fed or to the borrowers if the public would know exactly what kind of collateral the borrowers have put up.
There is a stigma that is associated with going to the discount window, recognized by central bankers around the world. In fact, no central bank in any developed country that I'm aware of discloses the kind of bank-by-bank loan information that's being sought by Bloomberg. And the concern is that if there's information about the fact that a particular bank, and it can be a small bank, has gone to the discount window, it might set off speculation about the safety and soundness of that bank, entirely unwarranted. And there may be an overreaction in the market.
And this is not a hysterical fear, necessarily. At the beginning of the subprime crisis, a leak about Northern Rock Bank's problems by the BBC resulted in a run on that bank.
That's correct. And in fact, the British government wrote a long report about what happened there. And exactly as you said, there was a run on the bank, which was caused by the speculation that surrounded the fact that the bank had gone to the UK equivalent of the discount window. There was a run on the Citibank Asian offices in the early 90s that was caused by rumors that Citibank had use the discount window. So this is a real concern. And in fact, banks have paid in the past substantially more money to borrow in private markets because they're concerned about the potential for a leak. You know, you want banks to be lending money. And if they have to go and fund themselves through expensive sources of liquidity, banks will make less loans. Less loans will ultimately result in less jobs.
Maybe, but if there were more transparency in the system, wouldn't the market adjust to the sort of normal business practice of financial institutions going to the discount window? Wouldn't there be less panic in the market if what is in fact a standard practice were simply more transparent?
And while transparency is an important virtue and something we want to encourage, in the business context, transparency needs to be balanced with the risk of having information be misused. SEC disclosure rules require public companies, including banks, to issue quarterly reports to shareholders. They disclose things like, you know, the amount of short-term borrowing that the company has engaged in. Those orderly disclosures prevent overreaction by the market, not, you know, every day whenever it goes to the discount window having to put out all this information explaining why it did it.
The loans we're talking about are now 2 years old, and I suppose perhaps they may have caused some disruption in the marketplace had the exact nature of the lending been disclosed in real time a couple of years ago. But now, a couple of years later, it's hard to imagine that there would be speculation in the marketplace over what happened in 2008, and yet you're still fighting the disclosure. Why is that?
First, banks are not similarly situated, so you can't really have a blanket rule that says, well, if the information is a year or two old, it's stale. For some banks, the fact that borrowing occurred 2 years ago could become important. And the key thing about the case is that it also would be a going forward disclosure. So, you know, this is obviously an important case both for the information they want, which is for, you know, a couple of year period, and then going forward. In addition, if you have disclosure of this information, albeit, you know, a year or two old, that disclosure may discourage banks from using the discount window, and our economy and our society benefits when banks have liquidity, make loans, and we don't want to discourage them from going to the discount window.
Bob, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Robert Jiffra is an attorney at Sullivan & Cromwell. All right, so now you know that the Jay Leno primetime experiment was a flop, and you know that Conan O'Brien has refused to move his Tonight Show back to midnight to accommodate Leno back to his former late-night slot. And you also know that O'Brien is now in play, maybe headed for Fox. And maybe you think, why, there has never been so much commotion in late night ever before. But you forget 1993, when the big flop was the Chevy Chase show, and Conan O'Brien was just being introduced to the world. Back then, when it seemed that anybody could get a talk show, All Things Considered let me use its air to audition for one of my own. The only stipulation was that my show had to conform with NPR's wonkish editorial sensibilities. Here's a cut-down version of it. Please note, all participants are real.
From Washington, D.C., the talk capital of the world, it's Drive Time with Bob Garfield. Here he is, my main man, Bob. Thank you.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much. Hey, what do you think of Lou Rawls and the Drive Time Nine? Thanks, fellas. Thanks a lot. Hey, Norm, how are you?
Fine. Evening, Bob.
That's quite a look there, Norm. Is that a sport coat or a Superfund site?
Hi-yo!
Folks, give it up for my pal and public policy guru on loan from the American Enterprise Institute, Mr. Norman Ornstein. Okay, all right, enough of that. Our first guest is a world-renowned psychologist, author, syndicated newspaper columnist, and broadcast personality. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome a woman who has done more shrinking than Oprah. Dr. Joyce Brothers. But listen, I think what everyone wants to know, Dr. Brothers, and please forgive me for asking yet again the question that I know everybody must ask, but do you believe a successful conclusion of the Uruguay round will affect trade barriers in the automotive sector with respect to the import market in Hungary?
Of course it will have a profound effect. As you know, Bob, Hungary's average import duties have already fallen from 50% to 17%. But the Uruguay round anticipates a further tariff reduction to 8%.
Yes. Hi-yo!
Who can forget it? Look, I know you have to run, and I just want to thank you again for joining us. I also know this means Regis and Kathy Lee won't be booking you for at least a year, and we sure do appreciate it. Ladies and gentlemen, Joyce Brothers! Please help me welcome a former star forward for the New York Knicks. He is a third-term Democratic senator from the state of New Jersey, chairman of the Subcommittee on Deficits, Debt Management, and Long-Term Economic Growth. Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for the Honorable Bill Bradley! Welcome back to the show, Senator. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Bob. It's always nice to be here.
Senator, the president, of course, has just submitted his proposed Health Security Act to the Congress. What ramifications do you foresee for meaningful deficit reduction if this legislation is substantially enacted?
Well, not only is health care reform consistent with deficit reduction, Bob, but it's absolutely critical, and particularly given the floating exchange rate regime that we operate from in the world,
it's going to be important to making us more competitive. Senator,
What?
Will you do a song for us?
A song? I don't have anything prepared, Bob. You got a piano over there?
Yes, we do. Lewis? Ladies and gentlemen, the musical stylings of Senator Bill Bradley.
So, bye-bye, Miss American Pie. Drove the Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. And good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing, "This'll be the day that I die. This'll be the day that I die." I know that you're in love with him, 'cause I saw you dancing in the gym. You both kicked off your shoes. Man, I dig those rhythm and blues. I was a lonely teenage bronken buck with a pink carnation and a pickup truck. But I knew I was out of luck the day the music died.
All right, we're running out of time. Lou and the boys will be appearing at Harrah's Lake Tahoe November 4th.
Norm, you'll be appearing...
I'll be appearing in the New York Times, the Washington Post Sunday Outlook section, C-SPAN, and the Valley Forge Music Fair, November 7th to 11th.
All right. Tomorrow night's guests are former President Richard M. Nixon, author J.D. Salinger, chess champion Bobby Fischer, and Professor Irwin Corey. See you then. Good night.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Wallo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and DJ Vogt, with more help from James Halver and Alex Goldman, and edited by our senior producer, Katya Rogers. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. John Keefe is our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.